Welcome to a special edition of Path to Zero, recorded from the Reuters Global Energy Transition Summit in New York City. Now, here's your host, Tucker Perkins.
It's always important to talk to journalists who are shining a light on the climate crisis around the world, and we have that opportunity while we're here in New York at the Reuters Global Energy Transition Summit. We're pleased to welcome Denise Chow, who covers climate change and science for NBC News. Denise, welcome to Path to Zero.
Thank you so much for having me.
We got so much to talk about here. We're in New York. There's a massive event that's going on that really highlights the need for a cleaner climate, and we're all living it. But let's first talk about you. Let's start with you. You know, you have a really interesting role. Your bachelor's degree, I believe, is criminology, right, from the University of Toronto. We know you grew up in Vancouver. Get a master's degree in journalism at NYU, and now you are kind of talking about science and climate change. Kind of walk us how that evolved.
Yeah, well, I would love to say that I had a plan, but it was really, it all kind of happened by accident, and I feel a little bit silly saying that, but it really was kind of by accident. In journalism school, I kind of focused a lot on just very general national reporting, and I never really envisioned myself doing anything in science reporting. I don't have a background in science. I've always been interested in it, and I've always been kind of naturally very curious. But when I graduated, basically, I was hired by a company that owns a number of science and technology news websites, and they offered me a position at space.com, and as the name suggests, it was everything to do with astrophysics, astronomy, spaceflight, and I kind of jumped at the opportunity, not really thinking about, you know, where that was going to lead me, and so I really enjoyed that. I became a big space nerd, and I did that for a couple of years, and then I kind of found myself wanting to do something with a little bit more urgency for our readers. Not to say that space isn't important, but, you know, in my personal time, I was reading a lot of, you know, folks like Elizabeth Colbert, who I know you've had on this podcast, which is awesome, David Wallace Wells, a lot of Bill McKibben, and I was thinking a lot about climate change just on my own time. And I found myself wanting to kind of join these rock stars of environmental and climate reporting and wanting to write about something that really was impacting a lot of people's lives back then and even more so now. And so that's kind of how I got here.
That's awesome. What an awesome story. And then now you work for NBC News, really, and you're a part of that climate unit. But as we keep learning, there's so many levels and so many dimensions of the NBC strategy. Kind of talk to us on a news day, what the news covers, maybe what some of the social, and how you interact with all that.
Sure, yeah. So NBC News has always covered climate change. But a few years ago in 2019, they really made an effort to focus that and make it a priority across the entire network. So I write for digital. Of course, we have a huge broadcast operation. And so in 2019, the company set up what we call the Climate Unit, which is a small team made up of producers on the broadcast side and then writers like myself and my colleague Evan Bush. And really wanting to elevate climate stories and be very thoughtful about how we put resources toward climate coverage. And so the idea is that we would have sort of cross-network. We do kind of like climate weeks. We do like themed weeks around, say, recycling, or we do energy transition, those kinds of things. And really just trying to make it so that across the news organization, climate is a big topic for us. And so I feel very grateful to work at a place that really does prioritize that and is really putting a lot of time and resources behind it.
And your beat, if you would, is much more about the scientific beat, right? As opposed to maybe the human elements of that or the policy elements. It's really more about the science.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you say that because for sure, when I first started at NBC News, it was that. And in some ways, in a lot of newsrooms, going back, say, like 10 years ago, climate stories were considered the purview of science reporters. It was considered mm-hmm. a science story. And I think that's evolved a lot. And certainly in my career, I've kind of come around to developing subbeats that are not necessarily digging into the science of climate change, because in some ways that's settled. We don't mm-hmm. have to relitigate that anymore. So right now, my sort of sub-beats within climate change focus a lot on extreme weather, extreme heat, and then also at kind of the nexus of human health and climate change. And that's where I've been focusing a lot of my attention in recent years, just kind of looking at what are the health impacts here in this country, but also around the world, because that is going to be such a big deal moving forward.
I want to come back to that because I love the nexus of human health and climate change, because I think that's a pet passion of mine, and I find it's rarely linked, right? Climate change is almost this independent thing of health. But let's talk about what we're experiencing today, because I would argue what we're experiencing today may be something we talk about as a function of climate change, but it's directly impacting our health, the children's health, not just in New York City, but really across the Northeast, and I guess down as far as North Carolina. So talk about, you know, kind of even the events that we're having today with wildfires, smoke, kind of how you would report on that.
Yeah, so this has been just a crazy week. I mean, I think talk about irony of like talking on a climate change podcast while the climate crisis is unfolding right outside of
the baseball game last night, I guess, for health concerns, right?
Yeah, and lots of closures all across the city and around the Northeast, really. But yeah, I mean, I think what is still happening this week in the Northeast is really indicative to me of what we talk about when we talk about this climate reality. We talk about that all the time, this idea of the new normal, which is kind of a weird phrase and it almost has no meaning anymore. But when we talk about just the ways that people's lives and livelihoods would be impacted, I mean, this is a perfect example of it. We're talking about, you know, wildfire smoke coming down from Canada and really kind of blanketing a huge portion of this country. And we saw air pollution levels record breaking, I think, in New York City. Yeah. And so I think for me, the reason this is so jarring is that it's not that New York City has never experienced wildfire smoke. I mean, sometimes when the wildfires happen out west, it kind of, the smoke will blow clear across the country. But obviously what we saw yesterday in particular and Tuesday as well was just a severe, you know, this is so much more severe than we've ever seen. And this is also happening in a part of the country that maybe is not as accustomed to it. And that to me is what climate change is all about, right? Like we saw these inflection points with the Pacific Northwest heat wave a couple summers ago, with the deep freeze in Texas. Like these are the outcomes that we should expect to see a lot more moving forward, that climate change is sort of raising the risk of all of these things happening. And by that nature, we're going to see these things happening in places where, you know, historically they haven't before, and you might have populations that are vulnerable and maybe don't know what to do in these circumstances and infrastructure that can't necessarily cope with it.
And to me, back to your point, it's such a vivid reminder. We spend so much time thinking about how to replace diesel fuel. And one of the net benefits of replacing diesel fuel is we clear the air. We clear the air of greenhouse gases, but more importantly, we clear the air of harmful particulate matter and NOx that's lung just so damaging to everyone's lungs, but particularly children's lungs. Today is a great example of the benefits of clean air, tend to a degree, the detriments of unclean air. So it kind of, to me, it's a vivid reminder to me of what we're trying to do, because left unchecked, normal air might look like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a really good point, is that we experienced really bad levels, you know, AQI levels that are sort of 300, 400 and above. And what's really kind of startling is when you think that there are some parts of the world where that's much more normal. And we experienced that for 2-3 days. There are parts of the world where, you know, a level in the 300s is much more commonplace. And so I think it really puts that into perspective of just the enormity of this problem that we are trying to solve, and just what's at stake, really.
One of the fun things in doing this podcast and having guests like you come, we get a chance to prepare and we read some of your work and we study, try to find, you know, common thinking in your work. But really pertinent to what we're talking about was a story you did on extreme heat and the quality of air, bad air, in Southeast Asia. And I might stop and let you tell us that actually it was there talking about the effort to design these warning systems. But walk us through that story, maybe how it impacted you and what you learned from it.
Sure, yeah. Well, you know, in hindsight, this was very well timed, because I did learn a lot from doing that reporting that Will presumably be something that we see this summer. So the story you're referring to, this was in early May. There was a pretty brutal heat wave that hit Southeast Asia. This was sort of multiple days of temperatures well into the triple digits. And this was kind of early in the season. And this was all happening at the same time that Thailand and Vietnam, they were really grappling with pretty bad air pollution. And so I was interested in looking at what we know about just kind of the health effects when those two things happen at the same time. And there's, you know, there's just tons in the scientific literature about the health impacts of heat waves and separately the health impacts of air pollution. And we're really just now trying, you know, getting a clear picture of what happens when those two things coincide. And that's so much a part of the climate change story, is that you have these risks that compound each other. And so I talked to a lot of researchers who had been doing some work out in California looking at what happens when you have really bad wildfire smoke and a lot of fine particulate matter in the air, and you have high temperatures. And they were finding, in some cases, that when you had those two things occur together, the risk of death increased by, I think it was around 21%, so pretty stark numbers. And so I think there's this concerted effort to improve our understanding of air quality, because I think with forecasting heat waves, we have a pretty good idea. We have a good idea of when those are going to hit, and we can have sort of a few days in advance to prepare and warn people and say, like, okay, temperatures are going to be quite high. With air quality, that's not necessarily the case. And so especially, I mean, here in this country, in more rural parts of the country, you don't necessarily have a lot of these air quality sensors, and certainly that's the case around the world. So we don't have a great picture of what air quality levels are like at any given time or place, depending on where you are. And so I spoke to a couple of researchers out in Colorado who have been doing a pilot program in India, trying to see if they can build an early warning system and how that can be built into local weather forecasts. So you would tell people, okay, we have a heat wave coming up. Air quality is also going to be quite bad. Here are the risks. Because I think communicating that to people is really important. I mean, we saw that unfold over the last couple of days, making sure people really understand what that means. I mean, an air quality index number means nothing if people don't know what to do or how to protect themselves. And so it was really about building an air quality early warning system that could be used around the world, but especially in developing nations where this might be a bigger deal.
You know, I have a friend, Scott Tinker, who's quite involved in the climate and from a geology perspective. But he has a saying that I've always loved: the Earth has one atmosphere and a fairly efficient conveyor belt. And you would think that, you know, we can predict temperatures and we should be able to predict flow of air and kind of make that story known. But as you pointed out in your article, it really hadn't happened yet, but it could be happening, should be happening.
Yeah, and I think over this summer, they're definitely testing it still in India. They're also in parts of Africa as well. So we'll see the results from that, and hopefully, you know, we see some improvements there.
Let's go to Bangladesh. You wrote a great story there about how climate change was negatively impacting women's ability to really conceive, and right, it was just a great story. Talk to us about that story.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for the kind words. That's really nice. But this story, it was very close to my heart because it is exactly the type of thing that I am, you know, borderline obsessed with, which is looking at the immediate impacts of climate change, but then also considering what I would consider to be secondary hazards. So when you have a place like in coastal Bangladesh, which is dealing with a lot of issues with sea level rise, it's a very low-lying country, and they're dealing with sea level rise, they're dealing with a lot of cyclones, more intense cyclones, and as a result of that, a lot of flooding. And so the immediate effects that we all know and that's much more visible is that, you know, people may lose their homes, they might get displaced, they might lose their crops. But then you have these secondary hazards which don't unfold immediately but are just as devastating to people who live there. And so this story that you mentioned, we followed a group of women in a village that's southeastern Bangladesh, right near the Sundarbans. And we were looking at sort of how their lives were impacted by what's known as saltwater intrusion, which is when you get sort of these really intense cyclones and a lot of flooding inland. The salt water essentially kind of spills into these rivers and lakes and ponds and really gets into the groundwater. And so it essentially cuts off clean and safe drinking water for a lot of these villages. And then you have people in this area who are primarily working at, you know, they fish for a living, and so they're standing waist deep in this water 8 hours a day, maybe upwards of 8 hours. And then they're bathing in this water, and they're drinking this water, they're cooking with this water. And what we know, which is, you know, this is still a very active area of research, is just looking at what those health impacts are. But we know that that causes the sodium levels to spike, and then there's all sorts of related health effects like hypertension and pregnancy complications for women who are pregnant. And so this story looked at just the reproductive issues that come along with saltwater intrusion. And it was such a brutal story. I worked with a freelancer on the ground, Tanbaril Rippon. He did some great on-the-ground reporting and just talking to these women who were so courageous and chatting with us about, you know, we're talking like 20-year-old girls who are having hysterectomies, you know, having miscarriages, just really, just heartbreaking stuff. And I'm really kind of thankful that NBC put a lot of resources toward this. We had a photographer on the ground, Fabeha Monir, who took some really amazing, very moving images for us. And it just was one of those stories that highlights how people in a part of the world that have not really contributed much to climate change are really suffering some of the greatest impacts.
Great. And I think my lesson from that, which I think about, but sometimes I brought it so home, is how the primary issue is climate change, but the secondary issue is kind of how it impacts you physically, floods, right, fires, whatever, I need to move, change, but then really how that impacts you in ways you never think about. And we could say stress, we can say it's chemical changes, whatever, but there's this primary, secondary, and then a really important tertiary issue that all started because of climate change.
Yes.
And as you write it, I'm curious, you know, we talk about Bangladesh, and I think about what that's like, or at least how I perceive it, Southeast Asia, so vulnerable, maybe not a great government system to rescue you. Can you translate some of those same stories to your work here in the United States or even in North America? I know you've spent a lot of time in Canada.
Yeah, I mean, obviously this is a very extreme case, and we're not seeing that unfold in exactly the same way here, but in, you know, the health effects of climate change are not, they don't just manifest in one way, right? Like when you have a more intense hurricane season, that affects people here in this country in ways that we've seen over the last couple of years. And so I think just making those connections, you know, that's kind of where I started to steer myself in the direction of looking at health and climate change, because I think climate change as a whole is an enormous topic. It's, you know, everyone, all of my climate journalist colleagues, even if we did this full time, we would still not be able to cover everything that
it's
we
so
want
enormous
to.
It's abstract.
It is, and it can feel overwhelming because there's so much that feels important to write about and that you want to cover, and that's just not possible or sustainable. And so I've tried to pick an area where I can really dig into that has an immediate impact on people's lives and also is something that they deeply care about. Mm-hmm. Your health, right? Like the health of yourself, your family, your children, whatever it is, that's something that it should be top of mind for everybody. And I think the more that us as journalists can connect those dots between, say, a scientific study, a report from the UN, whatever it is, and trickle down that those connecting factors into how that will affect you in your daily life, right, is so important.
Anything else? I mean, I know it has to. You're studying, you're seeing these stories. Anything else impact you personally as a story that needs to be told?
Well, I think this just came out this morning where NOAA scientists confirmed that El Nino conditions are here. We had been waiting for that. We sort of knew that was going to happen. That to me, it sort of sets the stage for, I would say, kind of a worrying few months ahead, let's say. A lot of the forecasts that I've looked at have suggested that, you know, with the return of El Nino conditions in general, what that means is it tends to supercharge tropical storm activity, but then for the rest of the country, so like the northern parts of the U.S. and Canada, it usually means hotter and drier conditions. And if we look at what's happening in Canada right now, they've already had just one of the worst starts, if not the worst start to their wildfire season.
They don't need hotter or drier.
They don't, right, and no, really nobody needs that at this right. point. And so I think that's going to be a big storyline for us in the next couple of months, just looking at what that will do for the summer temperatures. I mean, we're expecting it to be a hot summer already. 2016, which is the hottest year on record, happened in an El Nino year. So what does this mean for 2023? I mean, I think that's going to be a big thing, you know, for everyone to be covering.
And generally, hotter summers, perhaps colder winters, right? That's kind of how it starts off. But it's so different because it manifests itself in different ways in different parts of the country, certainly West Coast to East Coast.
Absolutely.
Is significantly different. Yeah, it's really, really concerning. I hadn't seen that they had confirmed that. Okay, let's move away from climate change, just because you said it yourself, but kind of as we study you, we know you kind of had this nice life in space, space reporting. It's kind of interesting. You want anything you want to tell us about that? And of course, I'd love to talk to you about Mars or, but anything you want to tell us that you learned in your time with space?
Well, I had a really interesting experience as a space reporter. I feel lucky in a sense that I became a space reporter when I did. It was a really exciting time when I first started. It was NASA was winding down the space shuttle program. So first of all, I got to cover the last three space shuttle missions, which felt, you know, historic and definitely very weighty. But then also sort of on the tail end of that was kind of covering a lot of the very, very early days of the commercial space industry. So, you know, folks like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, who were just really kind of getting started. And so that was kind of a really interesting dynamic shift. A lot of people thought that it would be very boring to be a space reporter in those years because you didn't have NASA being as big of a player. And as we've seen now, I mean, the space commercial space industry is enormous. There's like every single country almost wants to be involved in space somehow, and most companies as well. And so, you know, I still do a lot of space coverage. Climate change is kind of my main focus, but I am still a space reporter. And what's interesting is that they're not, I mean, they're not directly related, but they are in some sense. And I often feel from readers in particular tension between people who really want to see stuff like a mission to Mars, like you said, who want to, you know, are really championing a return to the moon, and people on the flip side who are like, you know, we've got so many problems here on Earth. Like, why are we spending money on that? And I certainly understand that point of view. I think, you know, there's a lot of value in thinking, you know, hard about what we prioritize and where the resources are going. And I mean, gosh, look around us. There's like no shortage of things that we could be tackling here on Earth. But to me, I don't think they have to be mutually exclusive. I think that, you know, you can put money and resources toward decarbonizing our country and sort of helping other developing nations do the same, as well as funding missions of scientific discovery. I mean, you can't necessarily always put a dollar amount on it, but the inspiration that people get from stuff that NASA does sometimes and also just the trickle-down technology and scientific benefits, it's harder to make that clear and sort of draw, you know, through lines for it. But I think there are benefits to society in doing both of those things, and yeah, we probably should.
It's funny, if you kind of look at history, and neither one of us were there really then, but the Apollo, the path to the moon seemed to be very galvanizing to all Americans, right? They seem, at least when you read it, it's like, we should do that. That's an immense moment of national pride, and mm-hmm. I don't know that anything has been so galvanizing since, really, but yeah, we are all in agreement with that as a strategy.
Yeah. And I mean, it gives rise to an entire generation of scientists, right? Like that, we wouldn't have had that without the Apollo program.
Fun fact for us is some of those rockets you mentioned, one of their fuels is renewable propane.
That's right.
I'm glad you know that. Yeah. Good. This is kind of one of the first times we really got firsthand work with renewable propane. Now it's moved into, you know, millions and millions of gallons, so it's interesting. Yeah. All right, we're going to have a little fun in a moment, but first, anything you're working on, anything you want to tell us about that's exciting you or challenging you?
Well, as I mentioned, extreme heat has been one of the topics in my subbeat, and I think that's, it's something that is going to, unfortunately, play out this summer and moving forward, and we really saw that in the last couple of summers, just how nobody on Earth is really immune to it. I mean, I think last year we had heat waves on every continent at one point, and so that's definitely a topic I'm focused on. We'll be writing about a lot more. Extreme weather, I mean, it sort of remains to be seen what hurricane season will look like. My colleague Evan Bush has been really on top of water issues, especially out west, and so I feel like those sort of three buckets are where we're really focusing our attention.
Yeah, I'm sure we're going to talk a lot more about adaptation, and we're going to, clearly, I think, at least everything I read suggests we're going to blow through the Paris protocols, right? And so some of those things say we'll catch up and we'll come back, but we're going to learn a lot more about what adaptation, I think, really means over the next decade, sadly.
Yeah, so. No, definitely. I agree with you.
Well, let's have just a little bit of fun. We use a little magic. We like to smile about it, but we're going to give you a magic wand. You use that magic wand for one thing in the next year that would have the most impact in your mind regarding climate change. Denise, how would you use that wand?
Okay, I think I would use my wand to make it so that people in top-emitting countries spend some amount of time, whether it's a day, a week, whatever it is, in the shoes of people who are in nations that have not contributed a lot to climate change but are really, even now, suffering pretty terrible effects from it. And I think that the reason I say that, which is such a Pollyanna answer, who even am I right now, I'm not sure, but but in all seriousness, I do think that experiencing it, seeing it for yourself firsthand, and having that lived experience really does change people, and I hope it will change people. And I think for me personally, an example I would give is that, I've been writing about climate change for a while now, and I've written about sea ice, I've written about glaciers melting, I've written about Greenland a lot. And a couple of years ago, I had the chance to go to Greenland on assignment. And I was shadowing a team of scientists out there who were studying Helheim Glacier, which is one of the fastest changing glaciers in Greenland. And I was on this like rocky cliff overlooking the calving front of the glacier, and just seeing that with my own eyes and hearing it, hearing everything around me, and just understanding just how far that glacier had retreated already was something that has colored my reporting and has really made me think differently about how I report on this topic. And so I was definitely changed by it. And I think that, seeing some of this stuff firsthand, because it's very difficult, us here in the US, and it's not true for everybody, but for some people, you feel very removed from it. And it's very easy to sort of tune some of this stuff out, because writing about climate change and ingesting this news is kind of like bad news upon bad news upon bad news. It's very understandable from a human psychology standpoint why you would become immune to some of this. And I think that the more people can have empathy for, people around the world, but also just the situation as a whole, just what we're going through as a global community, would really kind of, hopefully, especially for, lawmakers and business leaders, would hopefully cause them to sit up and pay attention and fight for a better, more livable future, because that's really what hangs in the balance.
Yeah, great use of your wand. Try to spend a little bit of time really understanding what it's like for those people that are so impacted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, agree. Great use of wand. All right, another fun thing we do is we like to plant a tree in a national forest in your name and in honor of your time with us and sharing your expertise and hopefully becoming, someone we regularly collaborate with. Where would you like that tree planted?
Well, I grew up in British Columbia and was sort of surrounded by trees all my life, and definitely took that for granted when I lived there, and miss it a lot while, living in New York here for almost 15 years. So I think this is a really nice tradition that you do. Thank you. I would probably choose Cathedral Grove in Vancouver Island. It's just a lot of old growth Douglas firs there. Beautiful place. And yeah, that's where I would choose.
Been there myself.
Oh, okay.
Lovely spot. Lovely spot. Anything else you want our listeners to know about you or something to watch for?
Oh, gosh. I mean, busy as always. Hopefully, I don't want to be busy. It would be great if there weren't a lot of climate stories out there, but unfortunately it is. And so, I think just more extreme weather stories, more extreme heat, we'll try to be on top of it and help our readers understand.
Well, let me help you. I encourage everyone to watch NBC News. Go to NBC.com, right? NBC.com?
NBCNews.com.
NBCNews.com, yeah. Sorry. And follow Denise there. Thanks so much for being with us on Path to Zero.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to path to zero at propane.com.